Bosch studied the shot of the toilet and noted the seat had been left up. The indication was that a male had used the bathroom to urinate. The cigarette ash would further indicate that it had been one of the two intruders. Bosch looked at the wall above the toilet. There was a small framed photograph of a winter scene. The leafless trees and steel gray sky made Bosch think of New York or somewhere else in the East. The photo prompted Bosch to remember a case he had closed a year ago while he was still in the open unsolved unit. He picked up the phone and called SID again. When Yates answered, Bosch asked for the person who checked the Kent house for latent fingerprints. "Hold on," Yates said. Apparently still annoyed with Bosch from the earlier phone call, Yates took his time getting the latent tech to the phone. Bosch ended up holding for about 4 minutes, using his glass to go over the photos from the Kent house the whole time. "This is Wittig," a voice finally said. Bosch knew her from prior cases. "Andrea, it's Harry Bosch. I want to ask you about the Kent house. What do you need? Did you laser the guest bathroom?" "Of course. Where they found the ash and the seat was up? Yes, I did that."
"Anything?"
"No, nothing. It was wiped."
"How about the wall above the toilet?"
"Yes, I checked there, too. There was nothing."
"That's all I wanted to know. Thanks, Andrea."
"Have a good one."
Bosch hung up and looked at the photo of the ash. Something about it bugged him, but he wasn't sure what.
"Harry, what were you asking about the wall over the toilet?"
Bosch looked at Ferris. Part of the reason the young detective was partnered with Bosch was so that the experienced detective could mentor the inexperienced detective. Bosch decided to put the Sherlock Holmes crack aside and tell him the story. "About 30 years ago, there was a case in Wilshire. This woman and her dog found drowned in her bathtub. The whole place had been wiped clean, but the lid was left up on the toilet. That told them they were looking for a man. The toilet had been wiped, but on the wall up behind it, they found a palm print. The guy had taken a leak and leaned on the wall while doing it. By measuring the height of the palm, they were able to figure out the guy's height. They also knew that he was left-handed."
"How?"
"Because the print on the wall was a right palm. They figured a guy holds his tool with his preferred hand while taking a leak." Ferris nodded in agreement.
"So they matched the palm to a suspect?"
"Yeah, but only after 30 years.
We cleared it last year in open unsolved. Not a lot of palms in the data banks back then. My partner and I came across the case and sent the palm through the box. We got a hit. We traced the guy to 10,000 palms in the desert and went out there to get him. He pulled a gun and killed himself before we could make the arrest."
"Wow."
"Yeah.
I always thought it was weird, you know."
"What, him killing himself?"
"No, not that.
I thought it was kind of weird that we traced his palm to 10,000 palms."
"Oh, yeah, ironic.
So you didn't get a chance to talk to him?"
"Not really.
But we were sure it was him, and I sort of took his killing himself in front of us as an admission of guilt."
"No, yeah, of course. I just mean I would have liked to talk to the guy and ask him why he killed the dog. That's all."
Bosch stared at his partner for a moment.
"I think if we had talked, we would have been more interested in why he killed the woman."
"Yeah, I know.
I was just wondering, why the dog, you know?"
"I think he thought the dog might be able to identify him. Like the dog knew him and would react in his presence. He didn't want to risk it."
Ferris nodded like he accepted the explanation. Bosch had just made it up. The question about the dog had never come up during the investigation.
Ferris went back to his work, and Bosch leaned back in his chair and considered things about the case at hand. At the moment, it was a jumble of thoughts and questions, and once again, most prominent in his mind was the basic question of why Stanley Kent was killed. Alicia Kent said the two men who held her captive had worn ski masks. Jesse Mitford said he thought the man he saw kill Kent on the overlook was wearing a ski mask. To Bosch, this begged the questions, why shoot Stanley Kent if he couldn't even identify you?
And why wear the mask if the plan all along was to kill him? He supposed that wearing the mask could have been a ploy to falsely reassure Kent and to make him cooperative, but that conclusion didn't feel right to him either. Once more, he put the questions aside, deciding that he didn't have enough information yet to properly go at them. He drank some coffee and got ready to take another shot at Jesse Mitford in the interview room. But first he pulled out his phone. He still had Rachel Walling's number from the Echo Park case. He had decided never to delete it. He pushed the button and called the number, preparing for it to have been disconnected by her. The number was still good, but when he heard her voice, it was a recording telling him to leave a message after the beep. "It's Harry Bosch," he said. "I need to talk to you about things, and I want my cigarette ashes back. That crime scene was mine." He hung up. He knew the message would annoy her, maybe even make her mad. He knew that he was inextricably heading toward a confrontation with Rachel and the Bureau that probably wasn't necessary and could easily be avoided. But Bosch couldn't bring himself to roll over, not even for Rachel and the memory of what they once had, not even for the hope of a future with her that he still carried like a number in a cell phone's heart. Chapter 10. Bosch and Ferris stepped out the front door of the Mark Twain Hotel and surveyed the morning. The light was just beginning to enter the sky. The marine layer was coming in gray and thick and was deepening the shadows in the streets. It made it look like a city of ghosts, and that was fine with Bosch. It matched his outlook. "You think he'll stay put?" Ferris asked. Bosch shrugged. "He's got no place else to go," he said. They had just checked their witness into the hotel under the alias Stephen King. Jesse Mitford had turned into a valuable asset. He was Bosch's ace in the hole. Though he had not been able to provide a description of the man who shot Stanley Kent and took the cesium, Mitford had been able to give the investigators a clear understanding of what had transpired at the Mulholland Overlook. He would also be useful if the investigation ever led to an arrest and trial. His story could be used as the narrative of the crime. A prosecutor could use him to connect the dots for the jury, and that made him valuable, whether or not he could ID the shooter. After Bosch had consulted with Lieutenant Gandel, it was decided that they shouldn't lose track of the young drifter. Gandel approved a hotel voucher that would keep Mitford in the Mark Twain for 4 days. By then, things would be clearer in regard to which way the case was going to go. Bosch and Ferris got into the Crown Victoria that Ferris had earlier checked out of the car shed and headed down Wilcox to Sunset. Bosch was behind the wheel. At the light, he got out his cell phone. He hadn't heard back from Rachel Walling, so he called the number her partner had given him. Brenner answered right away, and Bosch proceeded cautiously. "Just checking in," he said. "We still on for the meeting at 9? Bosch wanted to make sure he was still part of the investigation before updating Brenner on anything. Yes. Yes, we're still on for the meeting, but it's been pushed back."
"Till when?"
"I think it's 10 now. We'll let you know." The answer didn't make it sound like the meeting with the locals was a done deal. He decided to press Brenner. "Where will it be? At Tactical?" Bosch knew from working with Walling before that the tactical unit was off campus in a secret location. He wanted to see if Brenner would slip. "No, in the federal building downtown, 14th floor. Just ask for the TIU meeting." "How helpful was the witness?" Bosch decided to hold his cards close until he had a better idea of his standing. He saw the shooting from a distance. Then he saw the transfer. He said one man did it all, killed Stanley Kent, and then moved the pig from the Porsche to the back of another vehicle. The other guy waited in another car and just watched.
"You get any plates from him?"
"No, no plates. Mrs. Kent's car was probably the one used to make the transfer. That way there would be no cesium trace in their own car."
"What about the suspect he did see?"
Like I said, he couldn't ID him. He was still wearing a ski mask. Other than that, nada. There was a pause before Brenner responded.
Too bad, he said.
What did you do with him?
The kid, we just dropped him off.
Where does he live?
Halifax, Canada.
Bosh, you know what I mean.
Bosch noticed the change in tone, that and the use of his last name. He didn't think Brenner was casually asking about Jesse Mitford's exact location.
He's got no local address, he replied. He's a drifter. We just dropped him off at the Denny's on Sunset. That's where he wanted to go.
We gave him a 20 to cover breakfast.
Bosch felt Ferris staring at him as he lied.
Can you hold a second, Harry?
Brenner said. I got another call coming in here. It might be Washington.
Back to first names, Bosch noted.
Sure, Jack, but I can just go.
No, hold on.
Bosch heard the line go to music, and he looked over at Ferris. His partner started to speak.
Why'd you tell him we...
Bosch held a finger to his lips, and Ferris stopped.
Just hold it a second, Bosch said.
Half a minute went by while Bosch waited. A saxophone version of What a Wonderful World started to play on the phone. Bosch had always loved the line about the dark, sacred night. The light finally changed, and Bosch turned onto Sunset. Then Brenner came back on the line.
Harry, sorry about that. That was Washington. As you can imagine, they're all over this thing.
Bosch decided to draw things out into the open.
What's new on your end?
Not a lot. Homeland is sending a fleet of choppers with equipment that can track a radiation trail. They'll start up at the Overlook and try to pick up a signature specific to cesium. But the reality is it's got to come out of the pig before they'll pick up a signal. Meantime, we're organizing the status meeting so that we can make sure everybody's on the same page.
That's all the Big G has accomplished?
Well, we're just getting organized. I told you how it would be. Alphabet soup.
Right, you called it pandemonium. The feds are good at that.
Now, I'm not sure I said all of that, but there's always a learning curve. I think after the meeting, we'll be hitting this thing on all cylinders.
Bosch now knew for sure that things had changed. Brenner's defensive response told him the conversation was either being taped or overheard by others.
It's still a few hours till the meeting, Brenner said. What's your next move, Harry?
Bosch hesitated, but not for long.
My next move is to go back up to the house and talk to Mrs. Kent again. I have some follow-up. Then we'll go over to the South Tower at Cedars. Kent's office is there, and we need to see it and talk to his partner.
There was no response.
Bosch was coming up on the Denny's on Sunset. He pulled into the lot and parked. Through the windows, he could see that the 24-hour restaurant was largely deserted.
You still there, Jack?
Yeah, Harry, I'm here. I should tell you that it probably won't be necessary. You going back to the house and then by Kent's office.
Bosch shook his head. I knew it, he thought.
You've already scooped everybody up, haven't you?
Wasn't my call. Anyway, from what I hear, the office was clean and we have Kent's partner in here being questioned right now. We brought Mrs. Kent in as a kind of a precautionary thing. We're still talking to her, too.
Not your call.
Then whose call was it? Rachel's?
I'm not going to get into that, Harry.
Bosch killed the car's engine and thought about how to respond.
Well then, maybe my partner and I should head downtown to TIU, he finally said. This is still a homicide investigation, and last I heard, I was still working it.
There was a long thread of silence before Brenner responded.
Look, detective, the case is taking on larger dimensions. You have been invited to the status meeting, you and your partner, and at that time you will be updated on what Mr. Kelber has had to say and a few other things. If Mr. Kelber is still here with us, I will do my best to get you in to speak with him, and with Mrs. Kent too. But to be clear, the priority here is not the homicide. The priority is not finding out who killed Stanley Kent. The priority is finding the cesium, and we're now almost 10 hours behind.
Bosch nodded.
I have a feeling that if you find the killer, you find the cesium, he said.
That may be so, Brenner responded. But the experience is that this material is moved very quickly, hand to hand.
It takes an investigation with a lot of velocity. That's what we're engaged in now, building velocity. We don't want to be slowed down by the local yokels. You know what I mean.
Sure. I'll see you at 10, Agent Brenner.
Bosch closed his phone and started to get out. As he and Ferris crossed the lot to the restaurant's doors, his partner barraged him with questions.
Why did you lie to him about the wit, Harry? What's going on? What are we doing here?
Bosch held his hands up in a calming motion.
Hold on, Ignacio. Just hold on. Let's sit down and have some coffee and maybe something to eat, and I'll tell you what is going on.
They almost had their pick of the place. Bosch went to a booth in a corner that would allow them a clear view of the front door. The waitress came over quickly. She was an old battle axe, with her steel-gray hair in a tight bun. Working graveyard at Denny's in Hollywood had leached a life out of her eyes.
Harry, it's been a long time, she said.
Hey, Peggy. I guess it's been a while since I've had to chase a case through the night.
Well, welcome back. What can I get you and your much younger partner?
Bosch ignored the dig. He ordered coffee, toast, and eggs over medium well. Ferris ordered an egg white omelet and a latte. When the waitress smirked and told him that neither could be accomplished, he settled for scrambled eggs and a regular coffee. As soon as the waitress left them alone, Bosch answered Ferris's questions.
We're being cut out, he said. That's what's going on here.
Are you sure? How do you know?
Because they've already scooped up our victim's wife and partner, and I can guarantee you that they are not going to let us talk to them.
Harry, did they say that? Did they tell you that we couldn't talk to them? There's a lot at stake here, and I think you're being a little paranoid. You're jumping to...
Am I?
Well, wait and see, partner. Watch and learn.
We're still going to the meeting at 9, aren't we?
Supposedly. Except now it's at 10.
And it will probably be a dog-and-pony show, just for us. They're not going to tell us anything. They're going to sweet-talk us and brush us aside.
Thanks a lot, fellas. We'll take it from here.
Well, fuck that. This is a homicide, and nobody, not even the FBI, brushes me off a case.
Have a little faith, Harry.
I have faith in myself. That's it. I've been on this road before. I know where it goes. On the one hand, who cares? Let them run with the case. But on the other hand, I care. I can't trust them to do it right. They want the cesium. I want the bastards who terrorized Stanley Kent for 2 hours and then forced him down on his knees and put 2 slugs in the back of his head.
This is national security, Harry. This is different. There's a greater good here. You know, the good of the order.
It sounded to Bosch like Ferris was quoting from an academy textbook or the code of some sort of secret society. He didn't care. He had his own code.
The good of the order starts with that guy lying dead on the overlook. If we forget about him, then we can forget about everything else.
Nervous about debating his partner, Ferris had picked up the salt shaker and was manipulating it in his hand, spilling salt on the table.
Nobody's forgetting, Harry. It's about priorities. I'm sure that when things shake out during the meeting, they will share any information relating to the homicide.
Bosch grew frustrated. He was trying to teach the kid something, but the kid wasn't listening.
Let me tell you something about sharing with the feds, Bosch said. When it comes to sharing information, the FBI eats like an elephant and shits like a mouse. I mean, don't you get it? There will be no meeting. They put that out there so we would stay in line until 9 and now 10, all the while thinking we're still part of the team. But then we'll show up there, and they'll delay it again, and then they'll delay it again, until they finally trot out with some organizational chart that's supposed to make us feel like we're part of everything, when the reality is we're part of nothing, and they've run out the back door.
Ferris nodded as though he was taking the advice to heart, but then he spoke from somewhere else.
I still don't think we should have lied to them about the witness. He might be very valuable to them. Something he told us might fit with something they know about already. What's the harm in telling them where he is? Maybe they take a shot at him and get something we didn't. Who knows?
Bosch emphatically shook his head. No fucking way. Not yet. The wit is ours, and we don't give him up. We trade him for access and information, or we keep him for ourselves. The waitress brought their plates and looked from the salt spilled on the table to Ferras and then Bosch.
I know he's young, Harry, but can't you teach him some manners?
I'm trying, Peggy. But these young people don't want to learn.
I hear you.
She left the table and Bosch immediately dug into his food, holding a fork in one hand and a piece of toast in the other. He was starved and had a feeling they'd be on the move soon. When they would next have time for a meal was anybody's guess. He was halfway through his eggs when he saw four men in dark suits walk in with unmistakable federal purpose in their strides. Wordlessly, they split into twos and started walking through the restaurant. There were less than a dozen diners in the place, most of them strippers and their boyfriend pimps heading home from 4 o'clock clubs, Hollywood nightcrawlers, fueling the engine before putting it to sleep. Bosch calmly continued to eat and watched the men in suits stop at each table, show credentials, and ask for IDs. Ferras was too busy splashing hot sauce on his eggs to notice what was happening. Bosch got his attention and nodded toward the agents. Most of the people scattered among the tables were too tired or buzzed to do anything but comply with the demands to show identification. One young woman with a Z shaved into the side of her head started giving one pair of agents some lip, but she was a woman, and they were looking for a man, so they ignored her and waited patiently for her boyfriend with the matching Z to show some ID. Finally, a pair of agents came to the table in the corner. Their creds identified them as FBI agents Ronald Lundy and John Parkin. They ignored Bosch because he was too old and asked Ferras for his ID.
"Who are you looking for?" Bosch asked.
"That's government business, sir. We just need to check some IDs."
Ferras opened his badge wallet. On one side it had his photo and police ID, and on the other side his detective's badge. It seemed to freeze the two agents.
"It's funny," Bosch said. "If you're looking at IDs, that means you have a name. But I never gave Agent Brenner the witness's name. Makes me wonder. You guys over there in tactical intelligence don't happen to have a bug in our computer, or maybe our squad room, do you?"
Lundy, the one obviously in charge of the pickup detail, looked squarely at Bosch. His eyes were as gray as gravel.
"And you are?" he asked.
"You want to see my ID, too? I haven't passed for a 20-year-old in a long time, but I'll take it as a compliment."
He pulled out his badge wallet and handed it to Lundy unopened. The agent opened it and examined the contents very closely. He took his time.
"Hieronymus Bosch," he said, reading the name on the ID. "Wasn't there some sick creep of a painter named that? Or have I got it confused with one of the bottom feeders I've read about in the overnights?"
Bosch smiled back at him.
"Some people consider the painter a master of the Renaissance period," he said.
Lundy dropped the badge wallet on Bosch's plate. Bosch hadn't finished his eggs yet, but luckily the yolks were overcooked.
"I don't know what the game is here, Bosch. Where's Jesse Mitford?"
Bosch picked up his badge wallet and used his napkin to clean egg debris off it. He took his time, put the wallet away, and then he looked back up at Lundy.
"Who's Jesse Mitford?"
Lundy leaned down and put both hands on the table.
"You know damn well who he is, and we need to take him in."
Bosch nodded as though he understood the situation perfectly.
"We can talk about Mitford and everything else at the meeting at 10, right after I interview Kent's partner and his wife."
Lundy smiled in a way that carried no friendliness or humor.
"You know something, pal? You're going to need a Renaissance period yourself when this is all over."
Bosch smiled again.
"See you at the meeting, Agent Lundy. In the meantime, we're eating. Can you go bother somebody else?"
Bosch picked up his knife and started spreading strawberry jam from a little plastic container on his last piece of toast. Lundy straightened up and pointed at Bosch's chest.
"You better be careful, Bosch."
With that, he turned and headed toward the door. He signaled to the other team of agents and pointed toward the exit. Bosch watched them go.
"Thanks for the heads up," he said.
Chapter 11. The sun was still below the ridgeline, but dawn had a full grip on the sky. In daylight, the Mulholland Overlook showed no sign of the violence of the night before. Even the debris usually left behind at a crime scene, rubber gloves, coffee cups, and yellow tape, had somehow been cleaned up or maybe had blown away. It was as if Stanley Kent had not been shot to death. His body never left on the promontory with the jetliner view of the city below. Bosch had investigated hundreds of murders during his time with the badge. He never got over how quickly the city seemed to heal itself, at least outwardly, and move on, to act as though nothing had ever happened. Bosch kicked at the soft orange ground and watched the dirt drop over the edge into the brush below. He made a decision and headed back toward the car. Ferris watched him go. "What are you going to do?" Ferris asked. "I'm going in. If you're coming, get in the car." Ferris hesitated and then trotted after Bosch. They got back in the Crown Vic and drove over to Arrowhead Drive. Bosch knew that the feds had Alicia Kent, but he still had the key ring from her husband's Porsche. The Fed car they had spotted when they had driven by 10 minutes earlier was still parked in front of the Kent house. Bosch pulled into the driveway, got out, and headed with purpose to the front door. He ignored the car in the street, even when he heard its door open. He managed to find the right key and get it into the lock before they were hit with a voice from behind. "FBI, hold it right there." Bosch put his hand on the knob. "Do not open that door." Bosch turned and looked at the man approaching on the front walkway. He knew that whoever was assigned to watch the house would be the lowest man on the tactical intelligence totem pole, a screw-up, or an agent with baggage. He knew he could use this to his advantage. "LAPD homicide special," he said. "We're just going to finish up in here." "No, you're not," the agent said. "The Bureau has taken over jurisdiction of this investigation and will be handling everything from here on out." "Sorry, man, I didn't get the memo," Bosch said. "If you'll excuse us." He turned back to the door. "Do not open that door," the agent said again. "This is a national security investigation now. You can check with your superiors." Bosch shook his head. "You may have superiors. I have supervisors." "Whatever. You're not going into that house." "Harry," Ferris said, "maybe we..." Bosch waved a hand and cut him off. He turned back to the agent. "Let me see some ID," he said. The agent put an exasperated look on his face and dug out his creds. He flipped them open and held them out. Bosch was ready. He grabbed the agent by the wrist and pivoted. The agent's body came forward and passed him, and Bosch used a forearm to press him face first against the door. He pulled his hand, still clutching his credentials, behind his back. The agent started struggling and protesting, but it was too late. Bosch leaned his shoulder into him to keep him against the door and slipped his free hand under the man's jacket. He found and jerked the handcuffs off the agent's belt and started cuffing him up.
"Harry, what are you doing?" Ferris yelled.
"I told you nobody's pushing us aside." Once he had the agent's hands cuffed behind him, he grabbed the credentials out of his hand. He opened them and checked the name. Clifford Maxwell. Bosch turned him around and shoved the creds into the side pocket of his jacket. "Your career is over," Maxwell said calmly.
"Tell me about it," Bosch said.
Maxwell looked at Ferris. "You go along with this and you're in the toilet too," he said. "You better think about it."
"Shut up, Cliff," Bosch said.
"The only one who is going to be in the toilet is you when you get back to tactical and tell them how you let two of the local yokels get the drop on you." That shut him up. Bosch opened the front door and walked the agent in. He roughly pushed him down into a stuffed chair in the living room. "Have a seat," he said. "And shut the fuck up." He reached down and opened up Maxwell's jacket so he could see where he carried his weapon. His gun was in a pancake holster under his left arm. He would not be able to reach it with his wrists cuffed behind his back. Bosch frisked the agent's lower legs to make sure he wasn't carrying a throwdown. Satisfied, he stepped back. "Relax now," he said. "We won't be long." Bosch started down the hallway, signaling his partner to follow him.
You start in the office and I'll start in the bedroom, he instructed. We're looking for anything and everything. We'll know it when we see it. Check the computer. Anything unusual? I want to know about it.
Harry.
Bosch stopped in the hallway and looked at Ferris. He could tell that his young partner was running scared. He let him have a say even though they were still within earshot of Maxwell.
We shouldn't be doing it this way, Ferris said.
How should we be doing it, Ignacio? You mean we should be going through channels? Have our boss talk to his boss? Grab a latte and wait for permission to do our job?
Ferris pointed down the hallway toward the living room. I understand the need for speed, he said. But do you think he's going to let this go? He's going to have our badges, Harry. And I don't mind going down in the line of duty, but not for what we just did.
Bosch admired Ferris for saying we, and that gave him the patience to calmly step back and put a hand on his partner's shoulder. He lowered his voice so Maxwell would not hear him from the living room.
Listen to me, Ignacio. Not one thing is going to happen to you because of this. Not one thing, okay? I've been around a little longer than you, and I know how the Bureau works. Hell, my ex-wife is ex-Bureau, okay? And the one thing I know better than anything is that the number one FBI priority is not to be embarrassed. That is a philosophy they teach them at Quantico, and it seeps into the bones of every agent in every field office in every city. Do not embarrass the Bureau. So when we are done here, and we cut that guy loose, he's not going to tell a single soul what we did or that we were even here. Why do you think they had him sitting on the house? Because he's F.B. Einstein? He's working off an embarrassment, either to himself or the Bureau, and he's not going to do or say a thing that brings him any more heat.
Bosch paused to allow Ferris to respond. He didn't.
So let's just move quickly here and check out the house, Bosch continued. When I was here this morning, it was all about the widow and dealing with her, and then we had to run out the door to St. Aggie's. I want to take my time, but be quick. You know what I mean? I want to see the place in daylight and grind the case down for a while. This is how I like to work. You'd be surprised what you come up with sometimes. The thing to remember is that there's always a transfer. Those two killers left their mark somewhere in this house, and I think SID and everybody else missed it. There's got to be a transfer. Let's go find it.
Ferris nodded.
Okay, Harry.
Bosch clapped him on the shoulder. Good. I'll start in the bedroom. You check the office.
Bosch moved down the hallway and was to the threshold of the bedroom when Ferris called his name again.
Bosch turned and went back down the hallway to the office alcove.
His partner was standing behind the desk.
Where's the computer? Ferris asked.
Bosch shook his head in frustration.
It was on the desk. They took it.
The FBI?
Who else?
It wasn't on the SID log, only the mouse pad.
Just look around, go through the desk, see what else you can find. We're not taking anything, we're just looking.
Bosch went down the hall to the master bedroom. It appeared to be undisturbed since he had last seen it. There was still a slight odor of urine due to the soiled mattress. He walked over to the night table on the left side of the bed. He saw black fingerprint powder dusted across the knobs on the two drawers and its flat surfaces. On top of the table were a lamp and a framed photograph of Stanley and Alicia Kent. Bosch picked up the photo and studied it. The couple was standing next to a rose bush in full bloom. Alicia had dirt smudged on her face, but was smiling broadly, as if she were standing proudly next to her own child. Bosch could tell that the rose bush was hers, and in the background he could see others just like it. Farther up the hillside were the first three letters of the Hollywood sign, and he realized the photo was probably taken in the backyard of the house. There would be no more pictures of the happy couple like this. Bosch put the photo down and slid open the table's drawers, one by one. They were full of personal items belonging to Stanley, various reading glasses, books, and prescription bottles. The lower drawer was empty,
and Bosch remembered that it was the place where Stanley had kept his gun. Bosch closed the drawers and stepped into the corner of the room on the other side of the table. He was looking for a new angle, some sort of fresh take on the crime scene. He realized that he needed the crime scene photos, and he had left them in a file in the car. He walked down the hallway toward the front door. When he got to the living room, he saw Maxwell lying on the floor in front of the chair he had been placed in. He had managed to move his handcuffed wrists down over his hips. His knees were bent up with his wrists cuffed behind them. He looked up at Bosch with a red and sweating face.
"I'm stuck," Maxwell said. "Help me out."
Bosch almost laughed.
"In a minute."
He walked out the front door and went to the car, where he retrieved the files containing the SID crime scene reports and photos. He had put the copy of the emailed photo of Alicia Kent in there as well. As he walked back into the house and headed toward the hallway to the rear rooms, Maxwell called out to him,
"Come on, help me out, man."
Bosch ignored him. He walked down the hallway and glanced into the home office as he passed. Ferras was going through the drawers of the desk, stacking things he wanted to look at on top of it. In the bedroom, Bosch got the email photo out and put the files down on the bed. He held the photo up so he could compare it to the room. He then went to the mirrored closet door and opened it at an angle that matched the photograph. He then noticed in the photo the white terry cloth robe draped over a lounge chair in the corner of the room. He stepped into the closet and looked for the robe, found it, and put it in the same position on the lounge chair. Bosch moved to the place in the room from which he believed the email photo had been taken. He scanned the room, hoping something would poke through and speak to him. He noticed the dead clock on the bed table and then checked it against the email photo. The clock was dead in the photo, too. Bosch walked over to the table, crouched, and looked behind it. The clock was unplugged. He reached behind the table and plugged it back in. The digital screen started flashing 12 o'clock in red numerals. The clock worked. It just needed to be set. Bosch thought about this and knew it would be something to ask Alicia Kent about. He assumed the men who were in the house had unplugged the clock. The question was why. Perhaps they didn't want Alicia Kent to know how much or how little time had gone by while she waited tied up on the bed. Bosch put the clock issue aside and moved to the bed, where he opened one of the files and took out the crime scene photographs. He studied these and noticed that the closet door was open at a slightly different angle from the one in the email photo, and that the robe was gone, obviously because Alicia Kent had put it on after her rescue. He stepped over to the closet, matched the door's angle to the one in the crime scene photograph, and then stepped back to the door and scanned the room. Nothing broke through. The transfer still eluded him. He felt discomfort in his gut. He felt as though he was missing something, something that was right there in the room with him. Failure brings pressure. Bosch checked his watch and saw that the federal meeting, if there was actually going to be one, was to begin in less than 3 hours. He left the bedroom and made his way down the hall toward the kitchen, stopping in each room and checking closets and drawers and finding nothing suspicious or amiss. In the workout room, he opened a closet door and found it lined with musty cold-weather clothes on hangers. The Kents had obviously migrated to L.A. from colder climes, and like most people who came from somewhere else, they refused to part with their winter gear. Nobody ever knew for sure how much of L.A. they could take. It was always good to be ready to run. He left the contents of the closet untouched and closed the door. Before leaving the room, he noticed a rectangular discoloration on the wall next to the hooks where rubber workout mats hung. There were slight tape marks indicating that a poster or maybe a large calendar had been taped to the wall. When he got to the living room, Maxwell was still on the floor, red-faced and sweating from struggling. He now had one leg through the loop created by his cuffed wrists, but he apparently couldn't get the other through in order to bring his hands to the front of his body. He was lying on the tiled floor with his wrists bound between his legs. He reminded Bosch of a 5-year-old holding himself in an effort to maintain bladder control.
"We're almost out of here, Agent Maxwell," Bosch said.
Maxwell didn't respond. In the kitchen, Bosch went to the back door and stepped out onto a rear patio and garden. Seeing the yard in daylight changed his perspective. It was on an incline, and he counted 4 rows of rose bushes going up the embankment. Some were in bloom and some weren't. Some relied on support sticks that carried markers identifying the different kinds of roses. He stepped up the hillside and studied a few of these, then returned to the house. After locking the door behind him, he walked across the kitchen and opened another door, which he knew led to the adjoining 2-car garage. A bank of cabinets stretched along the back wall of the garage. One by one, he opened them and surveyed the contents. There were mostly tools for gardening and household chores, and several bags of fertilizer and soil nutrients for growing roses. There was a wheeled trash can in the garage. Bosch opened it and saw one plastic trash bag in it. He pulled it out, loosened the pull strap, and discovered it contained what appeared to be only basic kitchen trash. On top was a cluster of paper towels that were stained purple. It looked like someone had cleaned up a spill. He held one of the towels up and smelled grape juice on it. After returning the trash to the container, Bosch left the garage and ran into his partner in the kitchen.
"He's trying to get loose," Ferras said of Maxwell.
"Let him try. Are you finished in the office?"
"Just about. I was wondering where you were."
"Go finish up and we'll be out of here." After Ferras was gone, Bosch checked the kitchen cabinets and the walk-in pantry and studied all the groceries and supplies stacked on the shelves. After that, he went to the guest bathroom in the hall and looked at the spot where the cigarette ash had been collected. On the white porcelain tank top, there was a brown discoloration about half the length of a cigarette. Bosch stared at the mark, curious. It had been 7 years since he had smoked, but he didn't remember ever leaving a cigarette to burn like that. If he had finished it, he would have thrown it into the toilet and flushed it away. It was clear that this cigarette had been forgotten. With his search complete, he stepped back into the living room and called to his partner.
"Ignacio, you ready? We're leaving."
Maxwell was still on the floor, but looked tired from his struggle and resigned to his predicament.
"Come on, damn it," he finally cried out. "Uncuff me."
Bosch stepped close to him. "Where's your key?" he asked.
"Coat pocket, left side."
Bosch bent over and worked his hand into the agent's coat pocket. He pulled out a set of keys and fingered through them until he found the cuff key. He grabbed the chain between the 2 cuffs and pulled up so he could work the key in. He wasn't gentle about it.
"Now be nice if I do this," he said.
"Nice? I'm going to kick your fucking ass." Bosch let go of the chain and Maxwell's wrist dropped to the floor.
"What are you doing?" Maxwell yelled. "Undo me."
"Here's a tip, Cliff. Next time you threaten to kick my ass, you might want to wait until after I've cut you loose." Bosch straightened up and tossed the keys onto the floor on the other side of the room. "Uncuff yourself." Bosch headed to the front door. Ferras was already going through it. As Bosch was pulling it closed, he looked back at Maxwell sprawled on the floor. The agent's face was as red as a stop sign as he sputtered one last threat in Bosch's direction.
"This isn't over, asshole."
"Got it." Bosch closed the door. When he got to the car, he looked over the roof at his partner. Ferras looked as mortified as some of the suspects who had ridden in the back seat.
"Cheer up," Bosch said.
As he got in, he had a vision of the FBI agent crawling in his nice suit across the living room floor to the keys. Bosch smiled.
¶¶ Chapter 12. On the way back down the hill to the freeway, Ferris was silent, and Bosch knew he had to be thinking about the jeopardy his young and promising career had been placed in because of his old and reckless partner's actions. Bosch tried to draw him out of it.
"Well, that was a bust," he said. "I got nada. You find anything in the office?"
"Nothing much. I showed you. The computer was gone."
There was a sullen tone in his voice.
"What about the desk?" Bosch asked.
"It was mostly empty. One drawer had tax returns and stuff like that. Another had a copy of a trust. Their house and investment property in Laguna, insurance policies, everything like that is held in a trust. Their passports were in the desk, too."
"Got it. How much did the guy make last year?"
$250,000 take-home. He also owns 51% of the company."
"The wife make anything?"
"No income. Doesn't work."
Bosch grew quiet as he contemplated things. When they got down off the mountain, he decided not to get on the freeway. Instead, he took Cahuenga to Franklin and turned east. Ferris was looking out the passenger side window, but quickly noticed the detour.
"What's going on? I thought we were going downtown."
"We're going to the donut hole on Vermont."
"We just stayed an hour ago."
Bosch checked his watch. It was almost 8, and he hoped he wasn't too late.
"I'm not going for the donuts."
Ferris cursed and shook his head.
"You're going to talk to the man?" he asked. "Are you kidding?"
"Unless I missed him already. If you're worried about it, you can stay in the car."
"You're jumping about 5 links in the chain, you know. Lieutenant Gandil is going to have our asses for this."
"He'll have my ass." "You stay in the car. It will be like you weren't even there."
"Except what one partner does, the other always gets equal blame for. You know that. That's how it works. That's why they call them partners, Harry."
"Look, I'll take care of it. There's no time to go through proper channels. The chief should know what is what, and I'm going to tell him. He'll probably end up thanking us for the heads up."
"Yeah, well, Lieutenant Gandil won't be thanking us."
"Then I'll deal with him, too." The partners drove the rest of the way in silence. The Los Angeles Police Department was one of the most insular bureaucracies in the world. It had survived for more than a century by rarely looking outward for ideas, answers, or leaders. A few years earlier, when the city council decided that after years of scandal and community upset, it required leadership from outside the department, it was only the second time in the LAPD's long history that the position of chief of police was not filled by promoting from within the ranks. Subsequently, the outsider who was brought in to run the show was viewed with tremendous curiosity, not to mention skepticism. His movements and habits were documented, and the data was all dumped into an informal police pipeline that connected the department's 10,000 officers like the blood vessels in a closed fist. The intelligence was passed around in roll calls and locker rooms, text messages to and from patrol car computers, emails and phone calls at cop bars and backyard barbecues. It meant street officers in South LA knew what Hollywood premiere the new chief had attended the night before. Vice officers in the valley knew where he took his dress uniforms to be pressed, and the gang detail in Venice knew what supermarket his wife liked to shop at. It also meant that Detective Harry Bosch and his partner, Ignacio Ferras, knew what donut shop the chief stopped at for coffee every morning on his way into Parker Center. At 8 a.m., Bosch pulled into the parking lot of the donut hole, but saw no sign of the chief's unmarked car. The business was an aptly named establishment. Bosch killed the engine and looked over at his partner.
"You staying?"
Ferras was looking straight ahead through the windshield. He nodded without looking at Bosch.
"Suit yourself," Bosch said.
"Listen, Harry, no offense, but this isn't working.
You don't want a partner. You want a gopher and somebody who doesn't question anything you do. I think I'm going to talk to the lieutenant about hooking me up with someone else."
Bosch looked at him and composed his thoughts.
"Ignacio, it's our first case together. Don't you think you should give it some time?"
That's all Gandil's going to tell you. He's going to tell you that you don't want to start out in RHD with a reputation as a guy who cuts and runs on his partner.
I'm not cutting and running. It's just not working right.
Ignacio, you're making a mistake.
No, I think it would be best for both of us.
Bosch stared at him for a long moment before turning to the door. Like I said, suit yourself. Bosch got out and headed toward the donut shop. He was disappointed in Ferris's reaction and decisions, but he knew he should cut him some slack. The guy had a kid on the way and needed to play it safe. Bosch was not one to ever play it safe, and it had lost him more than a partner in the past. He would take another shot at changing the young man's mind once the case settled down. Inside the shop, Bosch waited in line behind two people and then ordered a black coffee from the Asian man behind the counter.
No donut?
No, just coffee.
Cappuccino?
No. Black coffee. Disappointed with the meager sale, the man turned to a brewer on the back wall and filled a cup. When he turned back around, Bosch had his badge out. Has the chief been in yet? The man hesitated. He had no idea about the intelligence pipeline and was unsure about responding. He knew he could lose a high-profile customer if he spoke out of turn.
It's all right, Bosch said. I'm supposed to meet him here. I'm late.
Bosch tried to smile as though he was in trouble. It didn't come out right, and he stopped.
He not here yet,
the counterman said. Relieved he hadn't missed him, Bosch paid for the coffee and put the change in the tip jar. He went to an empty table in the corner. It was mostly a takeout operation at this time of morning, people grabbing fuel on their way into work. For 10 minutes, Bosch watched a cross-section of the city's culture step up to the counter, all united by the addiction to caffeine and sugar. Finally, he saw the black town car pull in. The chief was riding in the front passenger seat. Both he and the driver got out. Both scanned their surroundings and headed toward the donut shop. Bosch knew the driver was an officer and served as a bodyguard as well. There was no line at the counter when they came in.
Hi, you, chief,
the counterman said.
Good morning, Mr. Ming, the chief responded. I'll have the usual.
Bosch stood up and approached. The bodyguard, who was standing behind the chief, turned and squared himself in Bosch's direction. Bosch stopped.
Chief, can I buy you a cup of coffee? Bosch asked.
The chief turned and did a double take when he recognized Bosch and realized he wasn't a citizen wanting to make nice. For a moment, Bosch saw a frown move across the man's face. He was still dealing with some of the fallout from the Echo Park case. But then it quickly disappeared into impassivity.
Detective Bosch, he said. You're not here to give me bad news, are you?
More like a heads up, sir. The chief turned away to accept a cup of coffee and a small bag from Ming. Have a seat, he said. I have about 5 minutes and I'll pay for my own coffee. Bosch went back to the same table as the chief paid for his coffee and donuts. He sat down and waited while the chief took his purchase to another counter and put cream and sweetener into his coffee. Bosch believed that the chief had been good for the department. He had made a few missteps politically and some questionable choices in command staff assignments, but had largely been responsible for raising the morale of the rank and file. That was no easy task. The chief had inherited a department operating under a federal consent decree negotiated in the wake of the FBI's Rampart corruption probe and myriad other scandals. All aspects of operation and performance were subject to review and compliance assessment by federal monitors. The result was that the department was not only answering to the feds, but was awash in federal paperwork. Already an undersized department, it was hard sometimes to see where any police work was getting done. But under the new chief, the rank and file had somehow pulled together to get the job done. Crime stats were even down, which to Bosch meant there was a good possibility that actual crime was down as well. He viewed crime statistics with suspicion. But all of that aside, Bosch liked the chief for one overarching reason. 2 years earlier, he had given Bosch his job back. Bosch had retired and gone private.
It didn't take him long to realize it was a mistake, and when he did, the new chief welcomed him back. It made Bosch loyal, and that was one reason he was forcing the meeting at the donut shop. The chief sat down across from him.
"You're lucky, detective. Most days I would have been here and gone an hour ago. But I worked late last night hitting Crime Watch meetings in three parts of the city."
Rather than open his donut bag and reach in, the chief tore it down the middle so he could spread it and eat his two donuts off it. He had a powdered sugar and a chocolate glazed.
"Here's the most dangerous killer in the city," he said, as he raised the chocolate glazed donut and took a bite.
Bosch nodded.
"You're probably right."
Bosch smiled uneasily and tried an icebreaker. His old partner, Kiz Ryder, had just come back to work after recovering from gunshot wounds. She transferred out of robbery-homicide to the chief's office, where she had worked once before.
"How's my old partner doing, chief?"
"Kiz? Kiz is good. She does fine work for me, and I think she's in the right spot."
Bosch nodded again. He did that a lot.
"Are you in the right spot, detective?"
Bosch looked at the chief and thought it was a loaded question. The chief might already be questioning his jumping the chain of command. Before he could work up an answer, the chief asked another question.
"Are you here about the Mulholland Overlook case?"
Bosch nodded. He assumed that the word had gone up the pipe from Lieutenant Gandil and that the chief had been briefed in some detail about the case.
"I work out for an hour every morning just so I can eat this stuff," the chief said.
"The overnights are facts to me, and I read them on the recumbent bike. I know you caught the Overlook case, and it's got federal interest. Captain Hadley also called me this morning. He said there is a terrorism angle."
Bosch was surprised to learn that Captain Dunbadley and the OHS were already in the picture.
"What is Captain Hadley doing?" he asked.
"He hasn't called me."
"The usual. Checking our own intelligence, trying to open lines with the feds."
Bosch nodded.
"So, what can you tell me, detective? Why did you come here?"
Bosch gave him a fuller rundown on the case, accenting the federal involvement and what was looking like an effort to shut the LAPD out of its own investigation. Bosch acknowledged that the missing cesium was a priority and true cause for the feds to throw their weight around. But he said the case was a homicide, and that cut the LAPD in. He went over the evidence he had collected and laid out some of the theories he had been considering. The chief had consumed both donuts by the time Bosch was finished. He wiped his mouth with a napkin and then checked his watch before responding. They were well past the 5 minutes he had initially offered.
"What aren't you telling me?" he asked.
Bosch shrugged.
"Not much. I just had a little dust-up with an agent at the victim's house. But I don't think anything will come of it. Why isn't your partner in here? Why is he waiting in the car?"
Bosch understood. The chief had seen Ferris when he scanned the lot upon his arrival.
"We're having a little bit of a disagreement on how to proceed. He's a good kid, but he wants to roll over for the feds a little too easy. And of course, we don't do that in the LAPD.
Not in my time, chief."
"Did your partner think it was appropriate to ignore the department's chain of command by coming directly to me with this?"
Bosch dropped his eyes to the table. The chief's voice had taken on a stern tone.
"As a matter of fact, he wasn't happy about it, chief," Bosch said.
"It wasn't his idea, it was mine.
I just didn't think there was enough time to..."
"Doesn't matter what you thought. It's what you did. So if I were you, I would keep this meeting to yourself, and I will as well. Don't ever do it this way again, detective. Are we clear on that?"
"Yes, clear." The chief glanced toward the glass display case where the donuts were lined up in trays.
"And by the way, how did you know that I would be here?" he asked.
Bosch shrugged.
"I don't remember, I just sort of knew."
He then realized that the chief might be thinking that Bosch's source was his old partner.
"It wasn't Kiz, if that's what you mean, chief," he said quickly.
"It's just something that gets known, you know? Word gets around the department."
The police chief nodded.
"It's too bad," he said. "I liked this place. Convenient, good donuts,
and Mr. Ming takes care of me.
What a shame.
Bosch realized that the chief would now have to change his routine. It would not serve him well if it was known where he could be found and when.
Sorry, sir, Bosch said, but if I might make a recommendation. There's a place in the farmer's market called Bob's Coffee and Donuts. It's a bit out of the way for you, but the coffee and donuts would be worth it. The chief nodded thoughtfully.
I'll keep it in mind. Now, what is it you want from me, Detective Bosch?
Bosch nodded. Time to get down to the business at hand. I need to take the case where it goes, and to do that, I need access to Alicia Kent and her husband's partner, a guy named Kelber. The feds have them both, and I think my window of access closed about 5 hours ago. After a pause, Bosch got to the point of the whole unscheduled meeting. That's why I'm here, Chief. I need access. I figure you can get it for me.
The chief nodded. Besides my position in the department, I sit on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. I can make some calls, raise some hell, and probably open the window. As I said before, we have Captain Hadley's unit on this already, and perhaps he can open up the channels of communication. We have been kept out of the loop on these things in the past. I can raise the flag, put in a call to the director.
Bosch nodded. It sounded like the chief was going to go to bat for him.
You know what reflux is, Detective?
Reflux?
It's a condition where all the bile backs up into your throat. It burns, Detective.
Oh.
What I'm telling you is that if I make these moves and I get that window open for you, I don't want any reflux. You understand me?
I understand.
The chief wiped his mouth again and put the napkin down on his torn bag. He then crumpled it all into a ball, careful not to spill any powdered sugar on his black suit.
I'll make the calls, but it's going to be tough.
You don't see the political angle here, do you, Bosch?
Bosch looked at him.
Sir? The bigger picture, Detective. You see this as a homicide investigation. It is actually much more than that. You have to understand that it serves the federal government extremely well with this thing on the Overlook being part of a terrorism plot. A bona fide domestic threat would go a long way toward deflecting public attention and easing the pressure in other areas. The war's gone to shit, the election was a disaster. You got the Middle East, the price of a gallon of gasoline, and a lame duck president's approval ratings. The list goes on and on. And there would be an opportunity here for redemption, a chance to make up for past mistakes, a chance to shift public attention and opinion.
Bosch nodded.
Are you saying that they might try to keep this thing going, maybe even exaggerate the threat?
I'm not saying anything, Detective. I am just trying to broaden your perspective.
A case like this, you have to be aware of the political landscape. You can't be running around like a bull in a china shop, which in the past has been your specialty.
Bosch nodded.
Not only that, you have local politics to consider, the chief continued. You have a man on the city council who lies in wait for me.
The chief was talking about Irvin Irving, a longtime commander in the department whom the chief had forced out. He'd run for a city council seat and won. He was now the department's and the chief's harshest critic.
Irving? Bosch said. He's just one vote on the council.
He knows a lot of secrets. It's allowed him to start building a political base. He sent me a message after the election. It was just two words. Expect me.
Don't turn this into something he can use, Detective.
The chief stood up, ready to go. Think about it and be careful, he said. Remember, no reflux, no blowback.
Yes, sir.
The chief turned and nodded to his driver. The man went to the door and held it open for his charge.
Thank you.
Chapter 13. Bosch didn't speak until they were out of the parking lot. He decided that by this time of day, the Hollywood Freeway would be overrun by the morning commute, and surface streets would be better. He believed that Sunset was the fastest way downtown. Ferras only made it 2 blocks before asking what had happened in the donut shop.
"Don't worry, Ignacio. We both still have our jobs."
"Then what happened?"
"He said you were right." "I shouldn't have jumped command, but he said he would make some calls and try to open things up with the feds."
"Then I guess we'll see."
"Yeah, we'll see."
They drove in silence for a while until Bosch brought up his partner's plan to ask for a new assignment.
"You still going to talk to the lieutenant?"
Ferras paused before answering. He was uncomfortable with the question.
"I don't know, Harry. I still think it would be best for both of us."
"Maybe you work best with female partners." Bosch almost laughed. Ferras didn't know Kiz Ryder, his last partner. She never went along to get along with Harry. Like Ferras, she objected every time Bosch went alpha dog on her. He was about to set Ferras straight when his cell phone started buzzing, and he pulled it out of his pocket. It was Lieutenant Gandil.
"Harry, where are you?"
His voice was louder than usual and more urgent. He was excited about something, and Bosch wondered if he had already heard about the donut hole meeting. Had the chief betrayed him?
"I'm on Sunset. We're heading in."
"Did you pass Silver Lake yet?"
"Not yet."
"Good. Head up to Silver Lake. Go to the rec center at the bottom of the reservoir."
"What's going on, Lieutenant?"
"The Kent car's been located. Hadley and his people are already out there setting up the CP. They've requested the investigators on scene."
"Hadley? Why is he there? Why is there a command post?"
"Hadley's office got the tip and checked it out before deciding to clue us in. The car is parked in front of a house belonging to a person of interest. They want you on the scene."
"Person of interest? What's that mean?"
"The house is the residence of a person the OHS has an interest in, some sort of suspected terrorist sympathizer. I don't have all the details. Just get there, Harry."
"All right, we're on the way."
"Call me, and let me know what's happening. If you need me out there, just say the word."
Of course, Gandil didn't really want to leave the office and go to the scene. That would set him back on his daily management duties and paperwork. Bosch closed the phone and tried to pick up speed, but the traffic was too thick for him to get anywhere. He filled Ferras in on what little he knew from the phone call.
"What about the FBI?" Ferras asked.
"What about them?"
"Do they know?"
"I didn't ask."
"What about the meeting at 10?
"I guess we'll worry about that at 10.
In 10 minutes, they finally got to Silver Lake Boulevard, and Bosch turned north. This part of the city took its name from the Silver Lake Reservoir, which sat in the middle of the largely middle-class neighborhood of bungalows and post-World War II homes with views of the man-made lake. As they approached the recreation center, Bosch saw 2 shiny black SUVs that he recognized as the signature vehicles of the OHS. Apparently, he thought, there was never much trouble getting funding for a unit that supposedly hunted terrorists. There were 2 patrol cars and a city sanitation truck as well. Bosch parked behind one of the patrol cars, and he and Ferras got out. There was a group of 10 men in black fatigues, also distinctive to the OHS, gathered around the fold-down rear gate of one of the SUVs. Bosch approached them, and Ferras trailed a couple of steps behind. Their presence was immediately noticed, and the crowd parted, and there was Captain Don Hadley sitting on the gate. Bosch had never met him, but had seen him often enough on television. He was a large, red-faced man with sandy hair. He was about 40 years old and looked like he had been in the gym working out for half of them. His ruddy complexion gave him the look of someone who had overexerted himself or was holding his breath.
"Bosch?" Hadley asked. "Ferras?"
"I'm Bosch. This is Ferras."
"Fellas, good to have you here. I think we're going to tie your case up for you in a bow in short order here. We're just waiting on one of my guys to bring the warrant, and then we go in."
He stood up and signaled to one of his men.
Hadley had a definite air of confidence about him.
"Perez, check on that warrant, will you? I'm tired of waiting. Then check the OP and see what's happening up there."
He then turned back to Bosch and Ferris.
"Walk with me, men."
Hadley headed away from the group, and Bosch and Ferris followed. He led them to the back of the sanitation truck so he could talk to them away from the cluster of other men. The captain adopted a command pose, putting his foot up on the back end of the truck and resting his elbow on his knee. Bosch noticed that he carried his sidearm in a leg holster that was strapped around his thick right thigh, like an Old West gunslinger, except he was carrying a semi-automatic. He was chewing gum and not trying to hide it. Bosch had heard many stories about Hadley. He now had the feeling that he was about to become part of one.
"I wanted you men to be here for this," Hadley said.
"What exactly is this, Captain?" Bosch replied. Hadley clapped his hands together before speaking.
"We've located your Chrysler 300 approximately 2.5 blocks from here on a street bordering the reservoir. The plate matches the Bolo, and I eyeballed the vehicle myself. It's the car we've been looking for."
Bosch nodded. That part was good, he thought. "What's the rest?"
"The vehicle is parked in front of a home owned by a man named Ramin Samir," Hadley continued. "He's a guy we've been keeping our eye on for a few years now, a real person of interest to us, you might say."
The name was familiar to Bosch, but he couldn't place it at first.
"Why is he of interest, Captain?" he asked. "Mr. Samir is a known supporter of religious organizations that want to hurt Americans and damage our interests. What's worse than that is that he teaches our young people to hate their own country."
The last part jogged Bosch's memory, and he put things together. He could not recall which Middle Eastern country he was from, but Bosch remembered that Ramin Samir was a former visiting professor of international politics at USC, who had gained widespread notice for espousing anti-American sentiment in the classroom and in the media. He was making media ripples before the 9/11 domestic terrorist attacks. Afterward, the ripples became a wave. He openly postulated that the attacks were warranted because of U.S. intrusion and aggression all around the globe. He was able to parlay the attention this brought him into a position as the media go-to guy for the ever-ready anti-American quote or soundbite. He denigrated U.S. policies toward Israel, objected to the military action in Afghanistan, and called the war in Iraq nothing more than an oil grab. Samir's role as agent provocateur was good for a few years of guest shots on the cable news debate programs, where everybody tends to yell at one another. He was a perfect foil for both the right and the left, and always willing to get up at 4 a.m. to make the Sunday morning programs in the East. Meantime, he used his soapbox and celebrity status to help start and fund a number of organizations on and off campus that were quickly accused by conservative interest groups and in newspaper investigations of being connected, at least tangentially, to terrorist organizations and anti-American jihads. Some even suggested that there were links to the Grand Master of all terror, Osama bin Laden. But while Samir was often investigated, he was never charged with any crime. He was, however, fired by USC on a technicality. He had not stated that his opinions were his own and not those of the school when he wrote an op-ed piece for the Los Angeles Times that suggested the Iraq War was an American planned genocide of Muslims. Samir's 15 minutes ran their course. He was eventually discounted in the media as a narcissistic provocateur who made outlandish statements in order to draw attention to himself rather than to thoughtfully comment on the issues of the day. After all, he had even named one of his organizations the YMCA, for Young Muslim Cause in America. Just so the long-established youth organization with the same internationally recognized initials would file an attention-getting lawsuit.